Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture on the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. We're competing with an ANU conference which is going on in the main committee room on a Bill of Rights. So we're competing with them, but they've also bumped us out of our room, which is why we're back in the black hole of Calcutta. Since about the early 1990s, there's been a revival of interest or a concentration on the importance of deliberation in a democratic system. And our guest today, Professor John Dryzik, was one of the pioneers, if not the pioneer, of this focus on the importance and value of deliberation. I could talk to you about the value of deliberation in Parliament, but I'd get myself into trouble, probably more trouble. But he has been concentrating on the importance of deliberation amongst the citizenry and has conducted an interesting little experiment in this regard, which is what he's going to tell us about today, and I'm sure you'll find it very enlightening. Please welcome him to the podium.
Okay, thank you. What I'm going to start with is actually a quote. I'll give you a few seconds to read the quote. We do not copy the laws and ways of other states. Actually, we are the pattern to others. Our administration places power in the hands of the many instead of the few. This is why it is called a democracy. Class considerations are not allowed to interfere with merit, nor does poverty bar the way. If a man is able to serve the state, he is not hindered by the obscurity of his condition. Now, can anyone here who does not have a PhD in political science tell me who that is a quote from?
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to...
Sorry.
I thought you were going to offer. Yeah. Okay. Can anyone tell me?
Pericles?
Yes, Pericles, Athenian statesman. This was from the famous funeral oration for the war dead of Athens 2,500 years ago. So he was celebrating Athens as a democracy. This is one of the founding documents, really, of democracy. Now, in ancient Athens, citizens could serve the state by being selected by lot. They were representatives, but they were not elected representatives. The Australian Citizens' Parliament actually is a world first, but in a way it takes us back to this very old conception of democracy and representation, a very old conception which actually predates elections. I'm going to return to Pericles at the end of the lecture, but before I begin in earnest, I'd like to acknowledge all the people who put so much time and energy into making the Citizens' Parliament happen. There are around 200 people working on the project at various times, almost all of whom were not paid. Even the ones who were paid weren't paid enough. They put a lot more time into it than they were paid for. So close to 200 people, that's in addition to our 150 citizen participants. First and foremost among the people who made it happen is Luca Belgiorno Nettis, who founded and funded the New Democracy Foundation, which made the Citizens' Parliament possible. Next, I'd like to thank my co-investigators on the Citizens' Parliament project, especially on my co-investigators on the Australian Research Council grant that also provided funding. Jeanette Hartz-Karp, who was the main organiser of the process and put so much energy into that. Lynn Carson, whose idea it was in the first place in a conversation with Luca Belgiorno Nettis. Simon Niemeyer, who's sitting at the front, who organised a lot of the research that went on around the project, as well as helping organise the process itself. Ron Lubensky, who was also our webmaster, and Ian Marsh. It will take me too long to list all the others who participated in the project, but I think there's a number of people here who sort of worked on it in various capacities, so would you like to stand up and take a bow if you did anything at all in connection with the Citizens' Parliament? Okay, too shy. But anyway, there are a lot of people who did work on it. I'd also like to point out, though, that this lecture represents my views on the way it all worked out, which are not necessarily shared by all the others who worked on the project. So what is the Citizens' Parliament, and why is it a world first? The Australian Citizens' Parliament was an assembly of 150 citizens, one from each federal electorate. Our youngest participant was 18, our oldest was 90. We began the selection process by sending out letters to around 9,000 people randomly selected from the electoral roll. Of the people we sent the original letter to, around 30% said yes, they would like to participate. That's really an astonishingly high positive response rate, especially given the demands on their time that we were going to make. And I think it gives the lie to all those people who say that ordinary citizens are not interested in participating in politics. If you give them some decent politics to participate in, an interesting opportunity, then a lot of people will reply with alacrity that they do want to participate. From this 30% who said yes, we did a further more or less random selection to get 150 citizens. I say more or less random because we had to make sure that we got a reasonable spread on the basis of age, education, and gender, and also several Indigenous participants. So we did tweak the selection a bit to ensure that. Technically, what we used was stratified random sampling. Okay, here's a picture of 150 citizens on the steps of Old Parliament House. One thing I should point out is that this actually looks like Australia. If you took a similar picture of the members of the House and Senate of this Parliament, they wouldn't look like Australia. Okay, so these are in a different sort of sense representative. We then invited our selected 150 to a series of one-day meetings, regional meetings, mostly held in capital cities, that explained the process and let them know what we would be asking them to do, and also got them to start thinking about the basic charge of the Citizens' Parliament, which is, how can Australia's political system be strengthened to serve us better? This is the regional meeting in Fremantle. So a relatively small number of people participating at this point in a number of different meetings. Now, the main meeting of the Citizens' Parliament was held over 4 days in February at Old Parliament House. But there was plenty for the citizens to do in the months leading up to the main event. In particular, they were all invited to participate in what we called the online parliament, in which they could form into groups to develop proposals and justifications for discussion at the main meeting itself. And we also opened the online parliament to those who did not make the final cut, and a fair number of them actually took the opportunity to participate. The main meeting in Canberra was co-chaired by Luigia O'Donoghue and Fred Cheney, and was opened by Senator John Faulkner. Now, when they arrived in Canberra, we worked the citizens really hard over those 4 days. We also demanded a lot of them for research purposes. We were, after all, partially funded by a grant from the Australian Research Council, and so they had to do lots of interviews, fill in lots of questionnaires, and so forth. And we actually generated a mountain of research data from the process, probably enough for at least 10 PhDs. Now, the timing of the main meeting turned out to be about as bad as it could be. It coincided with the weekend of the bushfires in Victoria, and so that meant we didn't get much in the way of media coverage, not surprisingly. And it was also horribly hot in Canberra. Our citizens were housed in student accommodation with no air conditioning. And so they had largely sleepless nights, I think, except eventually we did get them some fans. And then we worked them very hard all day. Now, the particular process that we used in the main meeting of the Citizens' Parliament was mostly based on what's called the 21st century town meeting model. Which was developed by our American colleague, Caroline Lukensmeyer, and her America Speaks Foundation. It's actually a very ingenious process, which uses sophisticated communications technology to synthesize the deliberations of large numbers of participants and feed back the results of those deliberations to them. We had 150 in our case, but actually can work for much larger numbers than that. And that was the main kind of process that we used, although we had lots of other kinds of sessions going on as well. And we also had some sessions in which it was possible for the citizens to ask questions of experts who were invited to make presentations. And also the experts could speak to the proposals that the citizens had generated. We held some plenary sessions in the House chamber, in Old Parliament House, but most of the action actually took place in the members' dining room, because that's, for our purposes, it provided much more in the way of a deliberative space rather than a space for debate. In the members' dining room, our participants were divided across 24 tables, each of which had a facilitator. Many of those facilitators were professional mediators or conflict resolution professionals, all of whom volunteered their time for the 4 days. And here's a picture of the members' dining room. Actually, the title says deliberating in the members' dining room, but I think this picture actually caught them when there was a tea break. So they're not actually involved in earnest conversation at this point. But there were 24 tables, each with a volunteer facilitator, and participants would periodically move between the tables. They deliberated particular proposals and could introduce new proposals or synthesize existing ones. Towards the end of the process, they could vote on the proposals that had been tabled. It's actually a fairly complex voting process, but to cut a long story short, they could allocate an imaginary 100 points between across the proposals that they as individually favoured. So each individual had 100 points to allocate. They could allocate them in whatever proportion they liked, and then we tallied up the points that each proposal got to form a final list of recommendations. And so this is how the final list of recommendations was generated. And this is what the top six looks like. So the first one was reduce duplication between levels of government by harmonising laws across state boundaries. The second was empower citizens to participate in politics through education. There's actually a lot more to it than this brief summary suggests. So there were some very sophisticated proposals for what kind of education would be desirable as part of this recommendation. Third was formal accountability regarding political promises and procedures for redress on the part of politicians who are elected. Sorry, that was third. Fourth is empower citizens to participate in politics through community engagement. Fifth, change the electoral system to optional preferential voting. This one is actually has an interesting background because it was originally proposed by a group who deliberated online, and their original proposal was actually to introduce first-past-the-post voting to Australia, which is the model of voting which, of course, is used in the United Kingdom, at least for the Westminster Parliament, and also in the United States for just about all elections. But as a result of being exposed to different points of view in the main meeting of the Parliament, this group actually decided that that was not a good idea. And so they rethought what kind of electoral system they would like based on the kinds of concerns they had, and they decided that optional preferential voting, as opposed to compulsory preferential voting, where you must list all candidates on the ballot paper, that optional preferential voting would actually meet their concerns better than first past the post. And finally, a series of measures to promote youth engagement in politics. These were the top six. There were a number of others too. The recommendations were then presented by several of our citizens in the House chamber, and they were received by the Prime Minister's Parliamentary Secretary, Anthony Byrne, who was representing the Prime Minister. So there are our nine presenters. While the content of the prioritised proposals is important, what is equally and perhaps even more important is the demonstration in the Citizens' Parliament of the sophistication with which ordinary citizens can deliberate complex questions of public policy and complex questions about the nature of our political system if they're given the chance and the opportunity. Now, so far I haven't really said much about why this was an exercise in deliberative democracy, and I haven't even said much about what deliberation is. Now, deliberation is a particular kind of communication that ideally induces reflection about preferences, about beliefs, and about the values that participants hold. It should induce reflection in non-coercive fashion, and ideally, when people make points or make arguments, they should be able to connect their particular point of view with some more general perspectives, so more general perspectives that are persuasive to others. So one of the key virtues of deliberative democracy is that of reciprocity. Reciprocity in deliberative terms is defined in terms of making arguments or communicating in terms that people who do not share your point of view can accept. So there's an effort to understand the perspective of others and to communicate in ways that make sense to their perspectives and not just your own. So the initial aim in deliberation is not to win. It's not debate. The initial aim is actually to understand. Deliberation allows that people are open to changing their minds and not just to convincing others, which is usually the task of debate. So the Citizens' Parliament was designed to ensure that that kind of communication took place, and our facilitators were there to encourage that kind of communication. Now, after the Citizens' Parliament concluded, I actually found it quite hard to listen to parliamentary debates, because the deliberative quality, you know, whatever else you might say about parliamentary debates, the deliberative quality in these debates is actually quite low compared to that which our citizens achieved. Doesn't mean there's no deliberation in Parliament, but there's much less than the kind than we achieved at the Citizens' Parliament. We can actually test this impression more systematically through using something called a discourse quality index, which was developed by our Swiss colleagues, some Swiss colleagues of ours at the University of Bern, a couple of whom actually came here for this Citizens' Parliament. Now, to apply the discourse quality index, we actually need a transcript of discussions. So we actually have that, because we actually recorded all the deliberations that took place, every one of those 24 tables, over the 4 days, and we can transcribe those recordings. I mean, obviously that's a huge amount of work for somebody. We haven't done it yet. But when it is done, what we can then do is go through the transcript and actually code every intervention that was made. We're not going to do that, because that would take, I think, several lifetimes if you did that with for every 24 table over 4 days. But we can take an example of the communications, a systematic example, and we can actually code them for their deliberative quality according to this index that that our Swiss colleagues have developed. We can then make a comparison with parliamentary debates. Our Swiss colleagues have actually done this. They've only done it for Parliament so far in a number of different countries. But that comparison between citizen deliberation and parliamentary deliberation would, I think, be very instructive. And that's actually the topic of a PhD being done by Catherine Kelly, whose PhD thesis I'm supervising at the moment. Now, the variation in deliberative quality between the citizens' parliament and this kind of parliament is perhaps not surprising, given that the citizens' parliament was set up with deliberation in mind, whereas parliaments in Westminster-style systems are not. They're set up with debate in mind. Parliaments in more consensual systems, such as Switzerland and, well, a number of other European countries, such as, for example, Germany, which work in more consensual terms, are actually not quite so undeliberative in these terms as Westminster-style parliaments. And our Swiss colleagues have actually demonstrated this in work that they've published, which compares the quality of deliberation in different kinds of parliaments. And they do find, quite systematically, that the quality of deliberation, according to the Discourse Quality Index, is better in consensual-style systems compared to adversarial systems. Now, I said that we did a lot of research in conjunction with the Citizens' Parliament, and so I'm just going to present one or two early findings. These findings were actually analyzed by Simon Niemeyer, who's sitting in the front row. Now, I'm not going to describe all the methodology in detail. That would just take too long. But basically, we did a lot of interviews at various stages during the process. Each of the four columns under A, B, C, and D represents one stage in the process. And A represents one particular kind of position that was held by citizens. I'll say what those positions were in a minute. And so just moving from left to right, the first, under, if you just look at A, the first column under A actually represents the strength of agreement amongst our citizens with that viewpoint at the very beginning of the process when we recruited them. The second represents their degree of agreement at the regional meeting. The third is when they arrived in Canberra. And then the fourth one is right at the far end, right at the end of the process, as they are about to leave the Citizens' Parliament. Now, what we can see is that there were substantial changes in the positions held by our participants over the course of the Citizens' Parliament process. The most striking, perhaps, is in position number C. And we find that it increased markedly as a result of participation in the main meeting in Canberra. Now, position C on the graph actually represents a point of view which has a positive appraisal of the Australian political system and the place of the citizens in it. The moral I draw from this is if you give people the opportunity to deliberate, they see the political system as something that they're a part of, something that is theirs and perhaps even worthwhile. So that explains the increase in agreement with factor C. Sorry, I'll use the word factor, that's getting a bit technical. Position C, okay? Position D on the graph represents a strong belief in participatory empowerment. This went up one of the interesting things is it actually sort of declined slightly in the early stage of the process, although that's probably not significant, and then goes up as a result of their participation in the Citizens' Parliament. This may not be surprising that people come to believe more in the desirability of participatory empowerment of citizens as a result of having participated in a process themselves. So perhaps that one is not surprising. Position B represents a more disaffected position, a degree of cynicism about the Australian political system and about the part of citizens in it. And as you can see, that there's there's a bit of a decline in that as a result of the... It goes up and then goes down after participation in the Citizens' Parliament itself. Position A is a position I call inclusive republicanism. It's actually republicanism with a small r rather than a big r. So belief in a republic is part of it, but only but more important is a belief in civic engagement and the need for the political system to be inclusive of all kinds of groups in society and all kinds of minorities, ethnicities, and so forth. And that sort of stayed pretty stable throughout the process. But there were some changes, in other words, and we're in the very early stages of trying to figure out why those changes occurred and what they really mean. But these are just some preliminary results. Oops. Hang on. Okay. Now, the subtitle of this lecture is A World First. This is not the first deliberative process that is based on the random selection of citizens. Other examples of this kind of process have been held throughout the world. They include deliberative opinion polls, a couple of which have been held here in Canberra, citizens' assemblies, consensus conferences, which were invented in Denmark, citizens' juries, invented in the US, planning cells, invented in Germany. So there are a number of related kinds of processes. The model closest to ours is the citizens' assembly. The first one of these was held in British Columbia about 3 years ago, where the Citizens' Assembly was organized by the provincial government to recommend a new voting system for British Columbia. And they ended up recommending a particular kind of proportional representation. Subsequently, citizens' assemblies were held in Ontario and also in the Netherlands, although the Netherlands one was not quite, it didn't really quite measure up to the British Columbia model. However, our Citizens' Parliament is still a world pioneer for three reasons. First, because it's national and based on one person from each electorate. Second, because of the online parliament component leading up to it, which is a very important part of the process. And third, and most important, because we put agenda creation in the hands of the citizens themselves. In the British Columbia case, they were told exactly what they needed to do. They were told they had to come up with a new voting system. And so there are a number of standard options available, and those were the options from which they scrutinized as part of the process. We were much more open-ended than that. And at the beginning, we really didn't know if this would work. We thought it might just produce chaos. That was our worst-case scenario. We hoped it would work, but it was really, in some ways, a sort of a leap into the dark in that respect. So we did, of course, give them a broad charge, which was how can Australia's system of government be strengthened to serve us better? But within this, they were free to craft their own options. And of course, they did in the process leading up to Citizens' Parliament and also during the course of the 4 days of the Citizens' Parliament itself. So that's the main sense in which this is a world first, in which this is an innovative process. Okay. So what did our citizens think about everything that had happened? For almost all of them, it was a very positive experience. For many of them, it was very profound. For some of them, it was even life-changing in terms of what they subsequently, after the Citizens' Parliament was over, decided that they want to do with their life, especially for some of the younger participants. Our oldest participant, Nola, wrote to us afterwards and said, so much to gain and learn, all meeting, with many ideas coming together from every part of Australia. History in the making, and I'm a very proud participant. One of our Indigenous participants wrote this: for a rare moment in my life, I actually felt a part of the majority and not minority. I would love to participate and learn further from this process and hope that it hasn't finished with one gathering. I think that everyone has so much to give. So these are just two of the comments. There were lots and lots in similar kind of vein. I mean, of course, some of them had a few criticisms of the way the process worked and some suggestions about how it might be done better. But for the most part, it was a really profound experience. We didn't ask our citizens to do anything by way of follow-up, but many of them decided to do things anyway. They did things like contacting their local member to communicate the results and recommendations of the Citizens' Parliament. Some of them have given talks to community groups and schools. Some of them had contacted the local newspaper to run a story on what happened, and some of them even wanted to organise local versions of the process. So there was a lot of energy that that was not exhausted by the few days of the process. Okay. In terms of follow-up, we eventually received a written response to the Citizens of Parliament final report from the Office of the Prime Minister, which said, and I quote, "The Prime Minister appreciates the commitment made by the selected citizens and many volunteers who helped make the event such a success. The report represents a constructive contribution to the ongoing debate about our system of government and how it can serve Australia and its people better." Well, yes, it does, but we were actually hoping for a bit more in the way of response than that, in terms of what might actually be done by way of follow-up, in the way of investigating some of the proposals, for example. Now, I promised at the outset I would return to Pericles. So here he is. It's a famous bust of Pericles. And the quote from him. And I'll just emphasize two sentences from that quote. "We do not copy the laws and ways of other states. Actually, we are the pattern to others." When it comes to democracy, we can actually apply that quote to Australia. Historically, Australia has been a democratic pioneer. Australia pioneered, among other things, votes for women and the secret ballot. For a long time in the United States, the secret ballot was actually known as the Australian ballot. So the Citizens' Parliament is really an innovation in this kind of tradition of Australian democratic innovation, and can be an example to others outside Australia, just like votes for women and the secret ballot were. And there is attention being paid to what we've done outside Australia. We had a number of international visitors who were here to observe the process as it happened, and there's been a lot of interest in it subsequently. So the big question is, where do we go next? And these are very much my own ideas rather than the ideas of my... Whoops, sorry. Okay. First, we might think about a formal role for institutions like the Citizens' Parliament. One possibility has been suggested by my American colleague, Ethan Lieb, in a book called Deliberative Democracy in America. In that book, he suggests that the institutions like the Citizens' Parliament might actually constitute a fourth branch of government, what he calls a popular branch of government, which would both scrutinize proposals generated by the other three branches of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, and also generate policy proposals that could be scrutinized by those other three branches in turn. Now, that's actually pretty unlikely in the United States. There's a very high degree of constitutional inertia that characterizes the United States, so it's very hard to get anything of that magnitude into the process. If we look at the United Kingdom, several years ago, in the context of debates about reform of the House of Lords, the think tank Demos actually produced a paper which suggested replacing the House of Lords by an assembly quite like ours, an assembly of citizens randomly selected by lot. Now, to me, it's perfectly obvious that such an assembly would do a much better deliberative job and certainly a much more inclusive democratic job than a house full of hereditary aristocrats. Now, the aristocrats are mostly now gone, but they've been replaced by lifetime appointees, political appointees. Some of them seem to have bought their way into the House of Lords. So in that kind of context, I think it'd be very easy to argue for an assembly like this one constituting a house of review, a deliberative house of review, as part of the formal architecture of government. Now, if we try to apply this to Australia, it would actually be a bit churlish of me to use a Senate lecture to call for the replacement of the Senate. My daughter has just been tracing our family tree, and it turns out I do come from a long line of churls, but I'm not that churlish. And of course, the Senate here has a degree of legitimacy conferred by the fact that it's elected, whereas the British House of Lords isn't. So I'm not going to recommend that. However, Queensland is currently lacking an upper house, has no Senate. And so I'd commend this idea to Queensland. Why not give this a try? Why not an upper house constituted by a randomly selected, constituted by a randomly selected assembly of citizens, perhaps serving for a year or so. Probably not much longer, because the longer they were there, the more likely they would be caught up in partisan politics. So I'd commend this idea to Queensland, as well as to Nebraska and New Zealand, which are amongst the parliamentary systems currently lacking an upper house. But however we do it, I think it's very clear to me that we need to create space for more deliberation in our politics. What we've worked on in the Citizens' Parliament suggests just one way. It's not the only way. My colleague John Yeo has written an excellent book called Deliberative Democracy in Australia, which focuses on how to make Parliament itself more deliberative. And a Citizens' Parliament itself could only ever be just one component of a broader deliberative democracy. A Citizens' Parliament, whatever its virtues, is not a deliberative democracy itself. It can only ever be one component of a deliberative system. We're always going to need much more than that to make a polity a deliberative democracy. In terms of what I'd like to do next, I think it'd be very interesting to start thinking about a global citizens' parliament. That's thinking really big. Now, a lot of political authority is currently exercised at the international level, at the global level, through things like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. And of course, the United Nations, which is perhaps less powerful than the institutions I've just mentioned. In today's world, the hallmark of legitimate authority is democratic authority, but very little of the authority exercised in the international system at the global level is democratic in any sense at all. There's a huge democratic deficit there, which maybe a global citizens' parliament could help reduce. A global citizens' parliament organized by random selection would actually be much more feasible than one organized by election. So, for example, think about China. You would need the approval of China for something like this to make it work. China is not going to agree to elections to a global parliament for obvious reasons. But you can imagine the Chinese government actually agreeing to random selection of a number of its citizens who could attend a global citizens' parliament. While I'm on the subject of China, deliberative democracy has, perhaps surprisingly, actually begun to make inroads in China, even as electoral democracy seems blocked. And even some figures in the Chinese Communist Party have even spoken about possibilities for introducing more in the way of deliberative experimentation in China. Of course, as long as it doesn't challenge the monopoly on power of the Chinese Communist Party, and I think they mostly want it confined to local levels as well. Now, before anyone can allege a communist plot to all this, let me point out that one of the ancestors of deliberative democracy, it has many ancestors, going back to ancient Greece, but one of the ancestors of deliberative democracy is Edmund Burke, who was the founder of conservatism, a British parliamentarian and political philosopher who over 200 years ago described Parliament as ideally being a deliberative assembly. I have a feeling he would be very disappointed in contemporary parliaments, especially in Westminster-style systems, in terms of the deliberative deficit in those kinds of parliaments. Getting back to the global citizens' parliament, in terms of the key actors who could help make it happen, China would be important. You would need their support. You would need the support of other governments too. I think it probably wouldn't be that much of a problem getting support from the United Nations itself and the Secretary General, because this kind of sort of global initiative, I think, would be very consistent with core United Nations ideals. The United States would be very important. Now, of course, under the last administration, you would have had considerable hostility to anything like this, because that administration could not accept anything much in the way of authority above the level of the United States itself. But actually, things are starting to look up for deliberative democracy in the United States now, especially with the Obama administration. That our American colleagues in the Deliberative Democracy Consortium, that's mostly based in the US, now have an entry to the Obama White House, and they're being sort of received into meetings in the White House discussing how to improve deliberative participation on the part of the citizenry in the United States. So there are actually some promising developments there. At the moment, they're only discussing ways of invigorating deliberative participation in the context of American politics itself, and they haven't yet started thinking about the global level. But I hope my American colleagues might be interested in going global. So, for anyone who remains skeptical concerning what I've said about the prospects for institutionalizing deliberative democracy, I'll just simply conclude by saying Yes, we can. And for more information, Sorry, we've lost a slide there. Sorry, I meant to go right to the, well, right at the end there's our website address, which is www.citizensparliament.org.au, but I can't seem to get there at the moment. Okay, so thank you.
Pericles didn't need computers. Yeah. So we have some time for some questions. Could I ask any questioners to go to the microphones? Side here, there's one up here. Just here, just on the steps here. Can you not see the microphone? any questions? Yep. Can you see that microphone over there?
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed that, and it's good to know you're not alone. There are others. Didn't the Democrats do something towards us when they were in power, like CIR?
Like what, sorry?
Citizens Initiative Referendum.
CIR. Yeah. Okay. Okay, CIRs are a bit different. I only gave you the top six of our proposals that came up from the conclusion of the Citizens Parliament, but actually Citizens Initiative Referenda were discussed as one possible proposal, and it didn't make the top six, but I think it made it probably made about number 11 or 12, if I remember rightly. But the Citizens Initiative Referenda are actually a bit different. I used to live in the state of Oregon in the US, where we did have Citizens Initiated Referenda, and they had been around for close on 100 years, I think. And so every 2 years on the ballot, you could vote on probably around 20 to 25 particular measures, ranging from closing the nuclear power plant in the state to tax limitation. But the thing about citizen initiated referenda, though, is that they're not necessarily deliberative. That in the Oregon case, if you wanted to get a measure on the ballot, all you had to do was collect, I can't remember what the percentage was, I think it's something like 6% of the voters in the state. 6% of people who had voted at the last gubernatorial election had to sign. But so the way you did that was you paid people to collect signatures. So you could pay people to collect signatures. You could then conduct advertising once you'd got the measure on the ballot. And there wasn't necessarily anything in the way of deliberation. I think what would be more interesting, if you are into citizen-initiated referenda, would be to try and figure out a way of making that process more deliberative. And the first thing you would do is ban paid signature collectors. So you really would have to convince people to sign, rather than just have somebody, convince people to devote their own unpaid energy to get signatures, rather than having somebody paid to get signatures. That'd be the first thing. The second thing you might want to do is actually have something like a citizens parliament, which deliberated the measure in advance of the election, have it publicized, have it televised, which would then give the broader citizenry something to go on, rather than just advertising campaigns.
Wouldn't one of the arguments of having this fairer debate, if you put the theory into practice, it'd be so long debating fairly and squarely that after a year you might get a few laws passed?
I'm not sure that's necessarily right. If you look at what we did in the Citizens Parliament, we actually, in retrospect, we went to the other extreme. We got too much passed in those few days. We would have had. The deliberative quality we had was fine, but it would have been still better, I think, if we'd actually focused on a smaller number of proposals. But we still managed to get closer at the end of it. Of course, it was done by voting. If you're waiting for consensus, that may take a long, long time. But you can have deliberation without necessarily seeking consensus.
Mm. So it's your wish, obviously, to get this through. I can hear people saying, well, so what?
What do you mean, so what? Mm. So what would mean, I mean, it depends on... The way I would justify it, I would say that there are at least two kinds of justifications. One would be just intrinsic democratic values. This is one way of making the system more democratic, okay? More inclusive, a different kind of way for citizens to make their voice felt. So that's one way. But I actually think that that there's an argument that can be made that this would actually produce better decisions. Yeah. You would get things thoroughly deliberated rather than just being the topic of adversarial debate. And this is why I think it'll be interesting to have a deliberative assembly like this as a house of review. It wouldn't necessarily be charged with decision making in itself, but it would be able to review proposals that had been debated in adversarial fashion elsewhere in the system, and could actually provide a new angle on them, a new insight into them. And so I think that's where its value might lie. You might want not to do it for everything, for every policy measure, but you could do it for some. Yeah. So I think that's what its value would be.
Thank you very much indeed. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Well, this is a comment and then a question. I actually happen to be one of the 150 guinea pigs.
Oh, okay.
There may be maybe others here. I don't know, but I was, I think, the member for Canberra, right. The Citizens' Parliament. And just on the citizens' initiated referendum proposal that came to the Citizens' Parliament, I think one of the very interesting things is that it came with quite a lot of force from a group that was working on it through the online Parliament. But it was heavily deliberated and modified during the 4 days to put into the proposal, particularly what you mentioned, John, a deliberative process, so that I guess you could guard against maybe highly technical matters getting through on a sort of a populist wave, which I think is the risk that a lot of people sort of see in those processes. So I think it was a very interesting example of how things worked in that deliberative citizens' parliament, that the CIR issue itself was heavily deliberated and significantly modified to make it a more deliberative proposal. Now, my question is, there's a whole bunch of those of us who are involved in the process that are now communicating on a continuing basis online, and I think that there's, well, I know that there's still a heck of a lot of enthusiasm for the event, and for seeing some sort of continuation. One of the proposals that came forward was linked to the six you had up there, was to have some sort of continuing body, agency, to promote citizens' engagement. Maybe that could be a creature of the state in some form or another, but maybe it would be better to be a citizens' commission of some sort, a continuing citizens' commission for citizens' engagement, that could look at the citizen engagement processes that we have in this country, and there are many and varied of those at all levels of government, could comment on them, could even take complaints about them when they didn't do what they were supposed to be doing, and make proposals to governments, federal and state, about how to improve engagement processes, and indeed maybe even initiate and manage further citizens' parliaments at national and state levels. What do you think of that?
Okay, I think that's a great idea. And I guess it's just illustrative of the kind of creativity that was unleashed amongst our 150 citizens. Because I must say, I think about democracy a lot, but I never actually thought of that one. But I think that would be a terrific idea. Actually, I should have mentioned, in terms of follow-up, that in terms of what the citizens were doing after the event, that there was this, there is this sort of ongoing online interaction. So thanks for reminding me about that.
Any other questions? Yes, would you like to trot across to the microphone.
I was wondering, when you gave the example of Queensland, why you hadn't also mentioned the Northern Territory and the ACT, particularly the latter, because probably more chance of it happening here. But I would have thought that, well, could you give some indication of just how you would mesh that in to an existing parliamentary system? I personally think it's an excellent idea, because I always thought that an element of randomness into the system would do no harm. I'd just be interested to see how you would mesh that into a working political system,
right?
Such as one of the ones we have here in the States or Territories.
Yeah, okay. You're dead right. I should have mentioned the Northern Territory and the ACT. I think the reason I didn't is that Queensland was in my mind because I think there was a media story recently on... I can't remember what newspaper it was, but anyway, there was somebody sort of sitting in the empty Senate chamber of Queensland, of the Queensland Legislature, and I thought, I know how we could fill that, and so that's probably what prompted that. But the ACT and the Northern Territory would be ideal candidates as well. How do we mesh it in? That depends on a number of things. First of all, if there's an existing upper house, then meshing it in would be perhaps slightly trickier. Then you'd need to call it something else. Maybe call it not sure what to call it. You know, Citizens Commission or something. I'm not sure what the name would be. But then presumably you could have selected issues would be referred to that. Not necessarily all issues. But selected issues. But on what basis would you select, and who would do the selection? Those would be the big questions, because presumably, if a government sort of knew that what it's proposing was controversial, but could get it through with using its legislative majority, then it probably wouldn't want that to be deliberated. So you would need some body independent of the government of the day, which would decide which legislation, which policies would actually get deliberated by the citizens' chamber, okay? So how do you constitute that body? Not entirely sure. That needs thinking through. There's room for deliberation about this question, about how exactly to make all this fit into the constitutional architecture. But I think you can sort of see solutions and ways to do it, which would like that sort of independent body which I've just suggested. The question, the only question there is we need to sort of think through exactly how that body itself would be constituted.
Now there was a question over here.
My question is a follow-up to Robin's point about a citizens' engagement commission. It sounds like a great idea. It's not entirely consistent with position A, namely inclusive republicanism, that is civic engagement, which declined after the Assembly's process. This suggests there's a bit of diffidence about engagement of the whole community. The one barrier that is obvious is the politicians' disinclination to have competition in their forums. But in the late 90s, the government actually commissioned a lot of work on what is citizenship. And this was very broadly based, not just schools, but adults too. And it seems to me two results of your work would be, one, that our democracy is unhealthy at the moment and needs some change. And two, that the broader notion of citizenship, not just gaining a right to vote, for example, but having a larger set of duties and responsibilities as well as rights, the notion of citizenship needs another push, like it was getting in the 90s, but just expired.
Right. Okay. If there is a problem with engagement, I suppose it can conceivably be from two directions. One could be that the politicians don't actually want it, and the second could be that the citizens don't want it. Okay. Now, when it comes to the politicians, I think it's telling that this Citizens' Parliament was, of course, not initiated by government. It was initiated from the outside. In some cases, in some of the other examples that I talked about, like the British Columbia Citizens Assembly, consensus conferences as they began in Denmark, those things were actually initiated by government itself. And so governments sometimes do it, but then sometimes they're not interested. I gave the example of Obama, whose White House does now seem to be interested in innovative ways of engaging citizens. Another example actually would be Gordon Brown in the UK, that when he became Prime Minister, he actually talked up things like this. And so he talked about initiating a whole range of citizens' juries on particular policy questions, on controversial policy issues. So this would be another answer to the question of, well, how do we build this into politics? The problem with that is that if it's not constitutionalized, you're relying on just the enthusiasm of a particular prime minister. And of course, once he's gone, and actually in his case, the enthusiasm didn't really last, but at least for a while it was there. So he talked about citizens' juries. He also talked about holding a national citizen summit, which would deliberate core values of the British political system, which I'm not sure was necessarily, it wouldn't have been my advice to do that, but that's what he was talking up, but that hasn't actually been held. So occasionally you do get politicians who do want to do something along these lines and are quite serious about it. In terms of the attitudes of citizens, would they want to participate? There's a lot of work been done on citizen participation and the degree to which, by political scientists, the degree to which people do want to participate in politics. And I don't want to enter into all the debates about that. But my own feeling is that if you give people the chance to participate in a particular kind of politics, of the kind that we offered them in this Citizens' Parliament, then they are interested. And I'll go back to the 30% figure of people who said yes, they would want to participate, of the 9,000 odd people that we contacted to begin with. That's really an incredibly high number given what we were demanding of them. So that's my conclusion, that people aren't necessarily apathetic. It's just that you have to give them the right kind of opportunity to participate, and they will, in many cases, jump at the chance.
That leads to something I was going to ask. There are some who would say, first of all, your random selection actually flushes out busybodies who want to meddle in everything, and you get people of particular strain of views not representative of the country. And secondly, that whether unwittingly or not, the organisers and the facilitators guide people in a particular direction. Have you got any comment on those two objections that have been made in the past?
Right. Okay. It's right that random selection gives you a particular picture of the citizenry. It's very different from most forms of public consultation, which attract people who are sometimes disparaged as the usual suspects. I think that's a bit unfair. But my Lynn Carson, who was one of the organisers of the Citizens' Parliament, refers to the incensed and the articulate, and those are the people who always show up at standard public consultations. And what a process like this does, like the Citizens' Parliament, we still get some people like that, but most people aren't like that. So we get actually a truer representation, I think, of the citizenry than those ordinary mechanisms of public consultation. There is a role for activism and for the incensed and articulate in the deliberative system, but what we give is a different kind of picture. Do the organisers guide the process and what happens in it? We did our best not to, okay? That doesn't mean we were necessarily always successful. I mean, the very fact that we were conducting a deliberative assembly implies that we believe in deliberation, and there's no getting away from that. But that doesn't mean that if you came to the Citizens' Assembly, you necessarily had to share in any kind of critique of the Australian political system. Luca Belgiorno-Nettis really started the New Democracy Foundation because he was unhappy with the way the two-party system worked, and he was interested in creative supplements to it. And so that was really his motive force for starting all this. But if we look at what the citizens actually came up with at the end, I think it'd be very hard to find any trace of the New Democracy agenda in there. that they actually turned out to be happier with a two-party system at the end of the process than they were when it began. So certainly there's no trace of the New Democracy agenda in there. And so all I can say is that we did our best to stop our own point of view conditioning what the citizens deliberated about. But in terms of the style of the interaction, well, there's no getting away from it that we were promoting deliberative interaction and not adversarial debate. But that was part of. But we were upfront about that with the citizens. I suppose they could have objected and said, "No, we'd rather have debate." But to my knowledge, none of them did. So.
Okay. Now we have an earnest questioner over here. You have a question, I hope.
Yes. I do have a question, but I'd like to congratulate you on using that beautiful blackboard. For the first time, I could sit and concentrate and listen. Congratulations for using that.
Okay.
It should be used more often. Now, the next part of my question, which will be this, congratulations on giving the Swiss the prominence they deserve. I carry with me something from my age when I started work of a thing called a tripod. And it related to the recall of persons, Arnie of California. It carries the recall of legislation. And it has, as you have mentioned already, the initiative. It seems to me the Swiss have given us the tripod that we can put, and it'll achieve every part of the points that you have made. Would you care to comment on that?
Okay. Actually, the ideal person to comment on it would have been André Backticker, who was actually here from Switzerland for the Citizens' Parliament, and so of course knows a great deal about the Swiss political system. That's right. The Swiss did give us the. I mentioned the experience of citizen-initiated referenda in the U.S., but it was really the Swiss who pioneered the use of referenda. I mean, they have referenda on all kinds of things, both the national and also the local, the cantonal level as well. But it's interesting, actually, getting a bit of history for a history lesson from André on how the initiative came into being. It came into being in Switzerland because. It is a consensual system in which just having a bare parliamentary majority isn't enough. And what they found was, I'm getting my history a bit mixed up here, my Swiss history. But it's the other way around, actually. It was the existence of the initiative which led to a consensual party system, because what they found was that after they had instituted the initiative and the possibility for referenda on all kinds of policy questions, that if a party was in the minority in Parliament, when it lost a vote, all it would do would be to send the measure to the citizens for a vote. And often it might overturn what the government had decided. So that was when they decided, okay, well, there must be a better way of doing this. So we need to bring all parties into government. And of course, that's what they do in Switzerland. All parties are represented in government. There's not a government in opposition. Okay, that makes the system more consensual. They have to work by consensus rather than just majority vote. That, in turn, improves the quality of deliberation in the Swiss Parliament. So we actually can trace, in this case, a direct causal link from referenda to a more deliberative political system. And so that perhaps is one lesson from Switzerland. But Switzerland is a very unique place. And we need to, I think, long and hard before saying, OK, just because it works in Switzerland, it could work here. But at least it did there, and it's something to think about.
OK, one last question, yes?
Thank you. I've got two suggestions. Number one, you mentioned earlier that it might be possible to do this on a global level. Mm-hmm. Would you consider doing that with senior children in school? If we're looking at 16 to 18-year-olds, in 20 years those folk will be the world leaders. And it could be a very interesting exercise to get this sort of a thing globally through that group. And then as a dead opposite, what would be the reaction if you did the same sort of thing with jail inmates? People who've fallen foul of the existing system, and many of them, as you know, highly intelligent, and it could be a very interesting alternative. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, thanks. Okay, two interesting ideas. Actually, children in school, that would be a great idea. That might be a way of pioneering it, and because you could frame it as a sort of an educational exercise, that might be a way of getting past some of the political objections that you might otherwise get. So that would actually be a very, very interesting thing to do, be it nationally. Actually, be interesting to do nationally as well as globally. Jail inmates, I hadn't thought of that one. The only thing that brings to mind, actually, is... there was a deliberative poll was held a few years ago in, I think it was in Britain. Deliberative polls are a bit different from our design, but they basically work by random selection of the citizenry to recruit participants. And I think the topic was actually criminal justice policy. And just as a result of random selection, they did have one or two participants who had actually spent time in prison. And so they could give their own insights into what punishment was like and what it did for people. So obviously what you're talking about is one that would be entirely composed of prison inmates. I think it might be an interesting process. It might be interesting to do that, possibly as part of rehabilitation of. Sort of reintegrating people into society once they had left prison. So it might be an interesting thing to do.
Okay, our time is up. Please join me in thanking our lecturer for a very stimulating lecture.